So we'll find the two clearly uncurved spaces. In which case you will see that the notion of a particle is a shaky one. Namely, particles apparently can be produced out of nothing, not just in collisions, but also out of nothing, and they can also disappear into nothing. And sometimes you can't even be so sure whether or not there is a particle. That may be observer dependent. In fact, much of that doesn't really require space to be curved or expanding or contracting. You can even see phenomena like that on flat space. That was first discovered by Bruno of the University of British Columbia in the 1970s. And that's the topic today. The Bruno effect can be interpreted as showing that the very existence or non-existence of particles can be observer dependent. This, of course, would seem to be very counterintuitive. Like, could it be that whether or not this can of pop exists or not is dependent on which observer is looking at it? In essence, it looks like that when you look at the Unruh effect at first. But I hope to show you at the end of the hour today that it's not mysterious at all. And you can really understand what that observer dependence is. So what is the Unruh effect anyway? By the way, it's usually pronounced Unruh effect because of the leading U, but it's a German name, and forgive me if I pronounce it in a German way. So the Unruh effect is the observation that an accelerated observer will see particles even though nobody else does. So if the quantum field is in its vacuum state, in the sense that there is no particle observable for any inertial observer, then that doesn't keep accelerated observers from finding particles apparently. Now what could be the intuition behind that? Before we actually cover that effect and derive it, what could be the intuition behind it? Well, here's one intuition about it. Let us consider a monochromatic wave in an inertial frame. So imagine you're an observer at rest or inertially moving. And you observe a monochromatic wave, a wave of constant wavelength in space and time. Then how does that wave look like to an observer who is accelerating, who is not inertial? Well, for that observer, the wave is not going to look monochromatic. Right? I mean, if for an inertial observer, this wave sounds, for example, like then for the accelerated observer, there's going to be a Doppler effect that changes, so the frequency is changing over time. Now that means that from the point of view of the accelerated observer, the mode oscillators appear to be coupled. You see, if the mode oscillators are not coupled, it means that each mode oscillator is oscillating on its own and will never affect any other mode oscillator. So if, for example, the mode oscillator for wavelength 5 is excited, then you have a wave for wavelength 5, and it stays like that. It's not going to excite the wave oscillator for wavelength 6, for example. However, that's not so for the accelerated observer, because the accelerated observer will see the same wave one moment as having a such and such wavelength, and another moment as having another wavelength. Which means that at the moment he thinks, oh, the such and such mode oscillator of this wavelength is excited, and then a moment later he thinks, no, no, it's no longer excited. Now another one is excited, one with a longer or shorter wavelength. Which means that for the accelerated observer, the mode oscillators hand their excitations to another. What is now an excited oscillator will no longer be an excited oscillator later. Instead, another oscillator with another wavelength will be excited. This, by the way, is also what's going to happen on an expanding spacetime. When the spacetime expands, the wavelength of a wave will change, which can be interpreted as the harmonic oscillators of the modes being coupled and handing the excitations to another. So if for the accelerated observer those harmonic oscillators appear coupled, then it could be that for this system of coupled harmonic oscillators, the ground state is a different one. And that would be a way to calculate what's happening. So the accelerated observer does a mode decomposition and then relates it to the inertial observer's mode decomposition. We choose the vacuum state for the inertial observer. Remember that our assumption is that an inertial observer doesn't see any particles. So we assume that the quantum field is in that state, no particles for an inertial observer. Well, and then we look at that state in the mode decomposition of the accelerated observer. And we would get a Bogoliubov transform between them, and we would see that there are particles for the accelerated observer where there are no particles for the inertial observer. That's one way of looking at it. And interesting things can be done in this way, because you can then see effects of horizons occurring. If, for example, the observer has a constant acceleration, then you can show that it has a horizon. There are certain events in space-time that cannot send messages to our observer because the observer is constantly accelerated. And that horizon can then be interpreted as having to do with the existence of those particles. This is often stressed a lot, but I would like to de-emphasize this view because I think it's wrong. The reason being that you don't need the horizon to get the Unger effect. You just don't, because the acceleration doesn't have to be continuous, doesn't have to be constant. A finite duration acceleration would do, and you see this already. This is not a new thing. You can read that in textbooks as well. It's just that there's a lot of emphasis on the picture with the horizon because there's a similarity to calculations with the black holes. But the Unger effect per se is not more general than this, and I think it's a distraction to think of it too much in terms of horizon. So instead, let us look at another intuition for what the Unger effect is, and what second strategy we might want to employ. Consider an accelerated detector of particles. Now, what is a detector? A detector ultimately is made out of particles itself. A detector is some quantum system. Even if it's a big detector, a heavy machine that you drag around, ultimately it's some quantum system. So an experiment that has a detector of field particles being accelerated is always an experiment that has two quantum systems that are coupled with another. There's the quantum system of the detector, and there's the quantum system of the field, and those two systems interact. So for example, the detector could be a photodetector, the quantum field could be the electromagnetic field. So this photodetector would detect photons. It's really two quantum systems. The quantum system of the detector, quantum system of the field, those two systems are coupled through an interaction Hamiltonian. Each has its own Hamiltonian, but the total Hamiltonian of the total system contains also an interaction Hamiltonian. Then what shall we understand a detection to be? Well, a detection could be understood, for example, as the event where our detector goes from its ground state to the excited state, to the first excited state. So that would be the detection. In the simplest case, you could think of a detector as being a hydrogen atom. And it can detect photons. For example, it can detect the presence of a photon by absorbing it and going from its ground state to its first excited state. Of course, you have to match the photon's energy to the energy gap of your detector, in this case, hydrogen. So a detector could be as simple as a hydrogen atom, or it could be a big machine. In any case, it's going to be some quantum system that has
some operators in it which couple to the operators of the quantum field. Because otherwise, the detector could not detect. Right? In other words, speaking physically now, a detector has to have a charge. If you have a detector that's made out of only neutral things, it could not possibly detect photons, because photons couple only to things that have charge. Okay? So as a general principle, your detector must have something in it that has a charge for the sort of particle that you want to detect, such as photons. Okay, but this is a key observation now, that any detector must have a charge in it. I mean, let's think especially of particles that we want to detect as photons. And our detector is something that has a charge in it. For example, in the case of the hydrogen atom being a detector, the electron, it has a charge. Okay? This is what sees the photon in this case. So why is that an important observation, that every detector must have a charge? Well, it is because we are accelerating that detector, which means that we are accelerating a charge. Okay? So if we are accelerating a charge, what are we expecting this charge to do? Well, accelerated charges act like antennas. They create excitations of the field. So if we take a detector of photons and we accelerate it, it will produce photons, just because we have an accelerated charge in the detector. If the detector were neutral, it couldn't detect, wouldn't be detected. So it has charges, or it has at least one charge, and we accelerate it, so it must produce photons. Our detector quantum system is interacting with the quantum field quantum system in such a way that the quantum field gets excited. But then, generally, if you have two quantum systems, A and B, and A interacts with B, it's quite plausible. In fact, it would be very unlikely that it wouldn't happen that B also acts on A. Right? I mean, basically, if you are hit with your fist on a wall, your hand is going to hurt. Right? So every action will produce some reaction. And so it's plausible, in fact, it has to be expected, that when you accelerate a detector, then its charge would, on the one hand, create an excitation in the electromagnetic field. But on the other hand, the quantum system of the electromagnetic field that's being acted upon will back react on our charge and excite the detector. So that means that if we take a hydrogen atom, for example, or any other quantum system that has a charge in it, accelerated, it's going to create photons on one hand, but on the other hand, the detector system itself is likely to get excited in the process. The important thing here is that the quantum field doesn't have to be excited from the start. We could have the quantum field in a vacuum state at the beginning. Then we take our detector, accelerate it, and the detector will lead to the detector's acceleration will lead to two phenomena. On the one hand, photons will be emitted in an antenna process. On the other hand, the electromagnetic field oscillators will act back on the detector to excite it. And that then leads to an effect that looks surprising if you don't look at it this way. It leads to the effect that the accelerated detector will get excited even though the quantum field started out in its vacuum state. But it's not a surprise, really. Because all you had done is you took the quantum system of the detector and had it interacted in non-trivial fashion with the electromagnetic field. And no wonder this thing, the electromagnetic field, acts back and excites the detector. So let us see these things in practice. And by the way, when we do this calculation, we will also see another reason to think that our particle interpretation of the excitations of the mode oscillators is the right interpretation. But we will understand it more deeply because we will understand that the registering of a particle by a detector doesn't have to mean that there was a particle in the first place. Yes?
You said that
No. It's true that the accelerated charge in a detector will create photons. They go away. They are not the ones that are being detected by the detector. The detector's quantum system is interacting with the harmonic oscillators of the quantum field. And even though they may be in the ground state to start, by being acted upon, they will act back. And that is what will excite the detector. It will interact, but it will not excite the field, and the field will not excite the detector. That's what we expect, but we have to calculate it, of course. It won't. If you just have a detector sitting there and the quantum field is in its vacuum state, then the detector will not detect any particles. Of course, as we will see, if the quantum field is in an excited state, if, let's say, one of its harmonic oscillator modes is excited, then the detector can detect the particle even though it is at rest, the detector, by absorbing that particle of the quantum field. It absorbs the photon, and the detector thereby goes up to an excited state. And that is what we mean by detection. Okay, enough words. We have to go to the math now. All right, so consider an observer who has a particle detector. Now, let tau be the eigentime of the accelerated observer and his or her detector. We now write the accelerated part as a function of the eigentime of the traveler, of our observer. So the path of our detector and observer is given by this four-component function, the function of the eigentime. X0 is the coordinate time in a inertial coordinate system, in the coordinate system of an inertial observer. And the x vector are the space coordinates in that inertial coordinate system. Inertial and Cartesian coordinate system. So for example, an observer at rest would have this path in four-dimensional space-time. Because the observer is at rest, it's moving only in the time direction, and the coordinate time is the same as the eigentime. It always sits, for example, at the origin of the coordinate system. Let us look at the case of constant velocity. If the velocity is constant, then the observer is moving at a constant rate in time, and it's also moving forward in space. I leave it to you to show that a squared minus b vector squared is 1 in this case. Another case is that of an observer and detector who have constant acceleration, let's say in the first space direction. In this case, the observer is moving forward in time with, according to a hyperbolic sine squared function, and moving in space with this function, and it's staying put in the x2 and x3 direction. Again, I leave it to you as an exercise to verify those things. It's just special relativity. We haven't introduced any curvature just yet. And here I'm giving you some hints about how to check that this really means constant acceleration. Now, the quantum field. Let us assume that the detector can detect particles of the Klein-Gordon field phi, which we can think of as the electromagnetic field, a simplified version of the electromagnetic field. So the particles that are to be detected would be photons. Just think of it in this way. Also, we will allow them to have mass. We will assume that for an inertial observer, the field phi is in the Minkowski vacuum. We'll usually assume that, but we will also look at the case where, for example, one of the oscillators is excited. Remember from what we covered before, we already know what the time and space dependent solution is to the Klein-Gordon equation for the quantum field theory. It's this expression here. Phi hat of x is the Fourier transform of the phi hat k. And for the purpose of the Unruh effect calculations, it's not necessary to put the system into a box, not necessary to put an infrared cutoff. It's actually a bit more tedious if we do that. Instead, we work with integrals over momentum space. Remember that the phi k of x naught were given by this expression here, where this mode function, the so-called mode function v, was simply that expression here, 1 over square root of omega k, e to the power I omega k x naught, where the frequency is given by the square root of k vector squared plus m squared. I'm not always consistent with putting those little arrow symbols on top of, for example, k vector or x vector. Okay, so the arrow symbol means it's the three space components that we square and sum up. In this thing, for example, the k vector squared. If we just write k vector, it would be a three-component vector. All right, so if we put this all together, we put that into here and this into there and then that into here, we eventually obtain that the full solution of the Klein-Gordon quantum field theory is this in Minkowski space. I think we had this expression already. Okay, so we seem to be all set. We know where the accelerated observer sits or moves, and we know what state the quantum field is in, except we haven't really described the detector quantum mechanically yet. That's what we still have to do. And once we have described the detector quantum mechanically, we have to couple it in a quantum theoretic way to the quantum field. So what about the accelerated detector? Assume that the accelerated detector is a quantum system which has discrete energy levels that we label E0, E1, E2, etc. Think of a hydrogen atom if you like, but it could be any multi-level system. It could be an atom, as I said, or for example, it could be a diatomic molecule such as H2, where you have a vibrational degree of freedom between the two atoms that make up this two-atom molecule. And the first energy levels of that vibrational system are actually pretty much equidistantly spaced because they are harmonic. Anyway, there are many such systems which have known energy levels. So our total quantum system consists now of two subsystems, namely the subsystem of the detector and the subsystem of the quantum field. The total Hamiltonian of this complete system is going to be the Hamiltonian of the detector, the Hamiltonian of the field, and an interaction Hamiltonian. So we have a quantum system for the detector. It has its Hilbert space on which its observables act. We have the quantum system of the quantum field, which has its Hilbert space on which all the field operators act. And the total quantum system will have as its Hilbert space a tensor product between those two Hilbert spaces. The total Hamiltonian acts on the tensor product of those two Hilbert spaces. And it acts in this way that it is the detector's Hamiltonian, which acts on the detector's Hilbert space, and so the identity operator on the field Hilbert space plus the identity operator on the field Hilbert space tensor the field's Hamiltonian, the quantum field's Hamiltonian acting on the quantum field Hilbert space. And then there's going to be an interaction Hamiltonian, which is going to be a Hamiltonian that acts non-trivially on both Hilbert spaces. Otherwise, the detector and the field don't see each other. So this is the factorization of the Hilbert space. The curly H stands for a Hilbert space. The interaction Hamiltonian has to consist of operators of both subsystems. And we can write it, for example, in this way. The Hamiltonian, the interaction Hamiltonian is the product of some operator in the detector's quantum system. That could be a momentum operator, for example, of the electron, if you use a hydrogen atom as a detector. Or it could be a position operator. In any case, it's got to be some operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the detector. And then we have the field operator at the place and time where the detector is at the moment. So the Hamiltonian is going to be time dependent. And wherever the detector is at the moment, the position is x naught x vector of tau. Wherever the detector sits at the moment, we look at the field operator, and that field operator is coupled to some observable in the detector. We also multiply the whole thing with a function epsilon of tau, which you can think of as a knob in the front of the detector. And you can switch the detector on, you can switch the detector off. And with the function epsilon of tau, you can describe in what time period the detector is on. Okay, so you could, for example, choose a function epsilon of tau, which is zero most of the time, and then it switches on, stays, let's say, one for a while, and then you switch off the detector, epsilon of tau drops to zero again. It's just a very convenient function to put in there. So in practice, we could have, for example, for the operator of the quantum system, the third component of the spin of an electron, for example, and the field could be, for example, the third component of the magnetic field. Just to give an example of an operator that acts on the detector's quantum system and an operator that acts on the field's quantum system. And what's the time evolution of all of this? Let us assume that detector efficiency is not all that great. So let us assume that epsilon of tau is never such a big number, which means that this coupling is weak. The interaction Hamiltonian is small, meaning that we can treat it perturbatively. So we can say the dynamics is governed by the free Hamiltonian of the detector, the free Hamiltonian of the quantum field, and the interaction is just a small perturbation. This helps us tremendously in solving the problem. Yeah? Yes, you see, if you have an electromagnetic field in practice, and you're hoping that one hydrogen atom is going to absorb your photon, the chances are low. So since we're going to do perturbation theory, it's going to be useful to use the Dirac picture of time evolution. I hope that you've all read up on how this works, the Dirac picture. What it means is that, well, it's, you know, it's an intermediate picture between the Heisenberg picture and the Schrodinger picture. In the Dirac picture, also called the interaction picture, the operators of the theory evolve according to the free Hamiltonians. So the field evolves according to its unperturbed Hamiltonian, and the detector evolves according to its unperturbed Hamiltonian, which means that the total system evolves, the operators of the total system evolve according to the Hamiltonian, to the free Hamiltonian, the free total Hamiltonian, which is just the free Hamiltonian of the detector plus the free Hamiltonian of the field. You see, if we use that Hamiltonian here, and we want to calculate what's the time evolution of an observable in the detector's quantum system, then we have to write the time evolution operator made out of the total Hamiltonian and put it and its inverse to the right and left of Q hat at the initial time. But you see, this thing here, the Hamiltonian, is a simple sum of those two terms. And the operator here is a simple product of the initial time operator and the identity operator, this thing being exponentiated. you can easily convince yourself that this amounts to a trivial thing regarding the second Hilbert space. And all you end up with is the time evolution operator of just the detector. And here as well, here the operator. This gives us the time evolution of just the detector and then tensor 1. We can pull this tensor 1 out of this time evolution. So states in the interaction picture evolve, however, according to the interaction Hamiltonian, which is time dependent. And the operators in the interaction Hamiltonian are also time dependent, because this is the Dirac picture. So the time evolution operator for the states in the interaction picture is given by the exponentiation of the interaction Hamiltonian. But we have to be careful. We have to use the time ordering operator here in front of it, because the interaction Hamiltonian is, in general, time dependent. And if it's time dependent, then it doesn't have to commute with itself at different times. So this is a non-trivial expression here. So what then is the ansatz of perturbation theory? Well, our assumption is that the detector efficiency, epsilon of tau, is small, in which case we can expand the time evolution operator. Remember, it only describes the evolution of the state now. We can expand this time-ordered exponential to just the first-order term, if what we're interested in is just the first order in the perturbation theory. So we get 1 plus the Hamiltonian, the interaction Hamiltonian. And here we have an integral from the initial time to the final time. Of course, this integral over time could be truncated. It depends on what we choose for our epsilon of tau. If we choose our epsilon of tau to be non-zero only for 5 minutes, then you have to carry that integral only for those 5 minutes, because the rest of the integration region epsilon is going to be 0. In fact, because we are free to choose epsilon of tau any way we want, we might as well let this tau run to infinity, because we can always just cut off the integral through epsilon. And later we will do that. So we will look at the overall time evolution when tau runs to infinity. So we, in effect, we give our detector an infinite amount of time to detect, in principle, except that we still reserve the right to actually specify when it's on and when it's off, choosing the function epsilon. It's just that we run our integrals all the way to infinity. OK, so we've set up the equations of motion. Now let us choose initial conditions. Let us assume that the quantum field starts out in a state that we may call alpha. And that state alpha could either be, let's say, the Minkowski vacuum, or let's say a one particle state. It could also be a 27 particle state, or a state that's a linear combination of a 5 particle and a 27 particle state. Anything goes in principle. Maybe not in reality, but in principle, we could write down these things. But we will just focus on the two cases where the quantum field starts out either in a ground state, no particles, or in a state in which we have one particle with momentum k. So obviously, what would we expect? We would expect that if it's an inertial observer, then it cannot register any particles if the initial state is the ground state, because there are no particles to absorb. And it can register a particle of momentum k, or energy omega, which is square root of k squared plus m squared, if the field starts out in this state in which there is a particle present to be absorbed. It's not going to be quite that easy, actually. We will find that the detector is able to detect a particle of a momentum other than k as well. depending on the circumstances, we'll find out. All right, further, we assume that the detector itself starts out in its ground state. We have to, because we say that detection is happening when the detector goes into an excited state. So the combined system of the field and the detector starts out in this state. Psi in is the ground state of the detector, and either the ground state or the let's say one particle excited state of the quantum field. Then the time evolution of the total system is such that at a later time tau, total system is given by that total state, a pure state in the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. So what about particle creation? The key question here is, what is the probability amplitude that if we measure at the time tau the detector system, that we will find that it is at an excited energy level? What's the probability amplitude that it has detected something, that it is excited? So what's the probability amplitude that we find the detector at time tau in the state En? Well, that probability amplitude is, of course, the bracket of the state that we know the system to be in at time tau, obtained by time evolving the initial state, and the state that we're looking for, namely a state that is an excited state for the detector and some state for the field. We haven't specified. In principle, the state of the field could be anything, but we will see soon that for this probability amplitude to be non-zero, we only need to look for certain states of the field. In the detection, no. If the detector is found at the energy level En, then it means that it has absorbed the energy En minus E naught. That's all it means. In principle, that could be because it has absorbed any number of particles whose energies add up to that amount. Could be one particle or a million. The only thing we know is that it has absorbed that much energy. All right, so intuitively it is clear that in a detection process, not really everything could happen. If you have one particle, let's say the detector is at rest, let's say the quantum field is in a state in which there is one particle present, then what do we expect that could happen? Well, it could happen that nothing happens, that the ground state, the detector stays in its ground state, and the quantum field stays in its state with one particle present. But what would also happen is that the particle of the detector, the particle of the quantum field gets absorbed, the detector gets one-fold excited. That's that. That would be a state E1, and here could be the vacuum, for example. But it's unlikely that the detector will register a particle and the field will suddenly have a million particles. I mean, we could put it in here, a state with a million particles, and ask what's the probability amplitude that a field with one photon and a detector that's in its ground state turns into a state where the detector is one-fold excited and there are a million particles. But it's unlikely that this is going to be non-zero. And in fact, in first-order perturbation theory, you will see that it's not going to happen and that we would have the vacuum state in this case here. So in principle, there's a lot to be tried out, but intuition will guide us and mathematics will tell us immediately what are the only states that have a non-zero probability of being found. So what is the detection probability? What is this bracket explicitly? Well, remember, that's what we need to calculate. the initial state evolved in time forward to the time tau. And that's the state that we try to find. So all we do now is write out explicitly what this is. We write the time evolution operator acting on the initial state of the total quantum system. And that's what we have here. Also, we run the detection time to infinity for convenience. Remember that in this integral here, we can always run tau to infinity, which means in principle we give the detector an infinite amount of time to do its job of detecting something. But we still have complete control over how long we keep the detector on through the epsilon function. All right, so we take this bracket and write it out explicitly. And then we get p infinity, the time that the probability amplitude for finding this state, the detector in the nth excited state and the field in some state omega, the probability for finding that state eventually is given by this time evolution operator. Remember, that's the first order derivation, acting on this initial state of the field, which is little omega, the initial state, ground state, one particle present perhaps, and this is the ground state of the detector. Right, so what we have to do now is have this thing here act on that, where the q is acting on that vector, and this thing is an operator acting on that vector. We notice right away that since En is an excited state, and E naught is the ground state, they have to be orthogonal to another, which means that this one drops out, okay? Because we have the bracket between this vector, the identity operator, and that vector. And even though the inner product between this vector, the bracket between the capital omega and the little omega, the field before and after may or may not be zero. We haven't specified what this is, and we haven't specified what that is. That may be non-zero. The inner product, the bracket between En and E naught is going to be zero. So therefore, the lowest order term goes away right away. You know, what is the one anyway? The one means no time evolution. Nothing has changed. And sure, if nothing has changed, then we're not going to find a detector in an excited state. Okay, so it's not surprising that this thing drops off. So we are left with having to evaluate the bracket between this, that operator, and this. Now let us collect the two different, what belongs to those two different Hilbert spaces. We have an En bracket with Q and E naught. That's this matrix element. Matrix element of that type are also called the transition matrix element because they, you know, transit between one state and another state. And we have the bracket between capital omega, the field phi, and little alpha, and the overall prefactor epsilon of tau we can just pull in front. Now, how does this thing, for example, evolve in time? This is an operator in the Hilbert space of the detector. It's there because the detector has a charge. How does it evolve in time? Remember, we work in the Dirac picture, which means that the operators evolve according to the free Hamiltonian. So this thing is evolving according to this time evolution operator that describes the free evolution of the detector alone. And that's very nice because, mathematically, it's very nice because what we have here is the Hamiltonian of the detector exponentiated to the right here and over there. And you see the Hamiltonian acting on an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian is just going to give us the eigenvalue. And here too, this is acting to the left on that, just giving us you just mean that in the Hamiltonian, in the exponentiated Hamiltonian, in that time revolution operator, the Hamiltonian is simply replaced by its eigenvalue. So what we find is that this matrix element here becomes that matrix element, the Hamiltonian here and the Hamiltonian there, exponentiated, just give us that expression here. Okay. This is where the music plays. This is where it's interesting because it has dynamics. This thing here is just a fixed number. Okay, it's just a fixed number because this operator is the charge operator at the initial time and some matrix elements of it. This number could be 5 for all we know. It doesn't really matter. It's not dynamic. It doesn't depend on space or time. It's just going to be some constant in front. If you want to actually make a prediction for an actual detector, then you have to model the detector precisely enough that you can put a number on it. But we are not going to fix exactly what type of detector we're working with, so we don't have to worry about what exactly that number is. It's some finite number. Now, what about this expression here? This matrix element here. Well, remember, we know what the field is as a function of space and time. This is the Dirac picture. We have to evolve the field only according to the free time evolution of the field, because the field is an operator. So all those operators are simply evolved in time according to the free Hamiltonian, and we know what that is. We know the full solution of the Klein-Gordon field in the case of no interaction. It's this. So all we have to do is put that lengthy expression in here. Unfortunately, we won't even need all of the terms here. Let's look at a special case. Let's first look at the case where the field starts out in the vacuum. What would we expect? Well, let's see what the math says, and then maybe we can interpret what that means. In phi hat of x, in this expression, do we really need all terms if this is the vacuum state? Shaking your head, because? That's right, exactly. This thing we don't need because the A is going to act on the zero operator here. We don't have to write zero in because it's, you know, it's a free field theory, zero in and zero out. So, yes, this thing is annihilating with the zero over there. So we only need to keep track of that thing here. This is what we have to put in there in the case that the field starts out in the vacuum state. Then what about capital omega? Remember what capital omega is? It's the state that we are looking for the field after the after the detector has done its job. So remember what this is, the whole thing. The whole thing is the probability amplitude for finding later the detector in the excited state En and the field in the state capital omega. So what could the state capital omega be for this whole thing to be non-zero? Remember, we have here the vacuum state being acted upon by the A dagger. So we have one particle state over here. So omega better be one particle state too. If you write here a zero particle or n particle state, then n not equal one, then that thing is going to be zero anyway. So first of all, we observe that in phi hat of x, only this term contributes because of that phenomenon. And also, if capital omega is an arbitrary state of the quantum field later on, only those contributions will survive in that calculation, which are one particle contributions. So in general, we can write capital omega as a linear combination of some constant times the vacuum plus some function of k, omega of k, times one particle state, plus some function of two momenta, k and k prime, times two particle state, etc., etc. This is how a general state of the quantum field theory looks like. All of the terms drop out except for this thing here. So we may consider, just to be specific, a particular state of the field, a one particle state with a particular momentum k tilde. We could smear this over with some function omega of k, but don't have to. All right, so we'll now be asking, what's the probability amplitude for the detector to get end up in the excited state En, and the field to have one particle gain? Okay?
The large one.
As I said, you could put a two particle state in there, but if this is a two particle state, then this bracket has to be zero, because if this is a two particle state, then you have here the phi hat contributing a dagger on the vacuum, so you have a one particle state in a product with, or bracket with a two particle state, and we know that they're orthogonal. So there's no chance that the detector will register excitation and the field acquires two particles or n particles. But remember what this means is, it means that even though we start out with a quantum field in its vacuum state, we seem to have a chance of getting a final state in which both the detector is excited and the field is excited. So it's not that the detector would suck some energy out of the vacuum. In fact, the detector, if it's accelerated, there's a chance that this is non-zero, as you will see. The detector will not only register a particle by or get excited, it will actually produce a photon too, even if there was none before. So if you put all those into our expression now, we find that the probability for the detector to eventually, waiting for an infinite amount of time, to eventually end up in state En, and the field ending up in that state, which means one particle of momentum k tilde. That probability amplitude is given by this. And we can evaluate this bracket now. See, we just have an A index k tilde and an A dagger index k. We can use the commutation relations between the two to move the A past the A dagger. And then we have an A acting on the vacuum, which annihilates. But because of the commutation relations, we also get a delta function between k and k tilde. Okay. So we are using the fact that this expression is occurring in here. And using the canonical commutation relations between A and A dagger, we can write this as that. The first term is vanishing because it's annihilated on the vacuum. And the second term just gives us this delta function. So therefore, we end up with this expression here. The probability amplitude for finding the detector excited into state En and the field to end up with one particle with momentum k tilde is given by this integral here. Now, at this point, we have to make choices. We've left the path of the detector open so far. It could be sitting at rest, could be moving inertially, or it could be accelerating. Let's make some choices here and see what happens. So first we do, we're still looking at the special case where the initial state of the quantum field is the ground state. So alpha is zero. Alpha is a ground state. And let us assume that the detector is inertial. Intuitively, this should immediately tell us there's not going to be anything happening there, right? Because it's a vacuum state, the detector is just sitting there. Why on earth would it register particles? So our expression now looks like this. Probability for the detector to get excited and the field to end up in a state with one particle of momentum k tilde present is given by this. And if the particle is sitting put at rest, then it's only moving in time. Let's say we put it at the origin, so all these are zeros. We can put that into our expression here. The k tilde times k vector vanishes because the x vector is just zero. And therefore, this entire integral here, which is the full expression that always holds, simplifies in the case of a detector that's just sitting at the origin to this expression here. But look at what that is. This is just Fourier factors. We can combine them that we have En minus, this is very hard to read here. En minus E0 and omega k. Okay? Sorry, I'll fix this. This is not easy to read. Sorry about that. Oh. See, it's okay actually in the source file. It's just, okay, how do we do that? Just make this a little bigger, maybe that helps. How about this? A bit better now, right? Yeah. All right, so En minus E naught tau, EI omega k tau. And remember what that is. If you integrate a plane wave, you get a delta function, right? Remember that the Fourier transform of a delta function is a plane wave. Fourier transform of a plane wave is a delta function. So we obtain that this is just the Fourier integral of the delta function, and that's what it is. No, it's just the delta function peaks when En minus E naught plus I plus omega k is zero. But that's never going to happen. Yeah? There is? Oh, yes, that is right. Thank you, yes. Good point. Okay. Right, so we get this delta function here, but this delta function is never going to peak. And that's because the En energy level is higher than the E naught energy level. We were asking the detector to raise its energy. So this is a positive number. And omega k, of course, is also positive because it's the square root of k squared plus n. So we may as well replace this whole thing by zero. So as expected, if the quantum field starts out in a vacuum and the detector starts out in its ground state and we wait for an eternity, then there is no probability amplitude for finding the detector in an excited state and the field in any state. The detector is not going to be excited on its own. Yep?
Try it out.
There is a loophole, but it's not that one. Let me show you what that loophole is. See, this integral here that we've been working with has an epsilon of t in there. And without telling you, I just dropped it. See that? Here's an epsilon of tau. It is gone. So at this point,
All right,
still there. But how far did I carry it? There it's gone. No, here it is, but here it's gone.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. All right. Okay. Always on. Okay. Yeah. I thought I did that earlier. Okay. So it's always on from here. That's a loophole here. Because imagine what happens if you keep the epsilon of tau in here. And you make it not constant in time. But instead, you're being realistic, and you say, nah, I have it zero for a while, and then I make it non-zero for a while, and then I drop it to zero again. I switch the detector on only for a finite amount of time. In that case, this is going to be an approximation of a delta function. And it's going to be an approximation which, if you switch it on hard, the epsilon of tau, if you switch on the detector hard and switch it off hard, so if this epsilon looks like that, then the Fourier transform gives you the Fourier transform of this. Instead of the delta function, you will get a function that looks like, like that, namely, sine of the argument over the argument, like sine x over x. It's not x here, but it's this. Okay? And that thing has a tail. It has a tail even for those negative values there, or for those positive values there. And that means the detector can actually get excited, even though the field started out in a vacuum. Now, how can we? Yes. True. We assume it to be small, but this doesn't have to be one. Okay? This could be very small here, and the probability for the detector to get excited could be very small. But the amazing thing is, it could be non-zero. How come it could be non-zero? Ultimately, that's an expression of the time-energy uncertainty principle. You see, if you know exactly at what time you measure something, you're not so sure about the energy. You have an energy uncertainty, and you see that the energy uncertainty immediately sneaks in and allows the detector to get excited, even though no particle was ever present. So that should already alert you to the fact that the excitation of the detector doesn't necessarily mean that a particle was there beforehand. It could be what is called a dark cloud. All right. Now let's look at the special case where the quantum field starts out in its ground state, and the detector is now non-inertial. So that's the true Unruh effect. So inertial observers will not see any particles. The quantum field is in its ground state. But what about accelerated detectors? Well, the probability amplitude for the detector to become excited will depend on the excitation energy, En minus E naught. Namely, you see, we can just recycle the expression that we had above. The only difference is that now the path is no longer going to be a trivial one, no longer just sitting there. But it's still exactly the same expression that we had before. So the probability amplitude for finding the detector excited in the state En and the field to have acquired a photon of momentum k tilde is given by that expression. If the field started out in the vacuum, the detector in the ground state, and the detector is following that path, x naught of tau, x vector of tau. OK, so this prefactor, we said, is just a constant that depends on the actual build of the detector. That's our Fourier factor here again. And it used to be multiplied with just another phase over here that's proportional to tau, which made it easy to see that you get a delta function. But here now, this is some function of tau. Some function of tau, which in general is not going to be proportional to tau, especially if you reconsider, for example, how the path in four-dimensional space-time looks like for an observer that is constantly accelerated. You get the hyperbolic sine of tau. That's not proportional to tau. And so in general, this thing is not proportional to tau. And therefore, this Fourier transform is not a delta function. And in general, you get some fairly arbitrary function coming out of it. So for generic accelerated detectors, this function here, the function that depends on the path of the detector and the time that it switched on, that function will possess the Fourier transform, which you may call F excitation. Well, it's really the probability amplitude except for the speculating prefactor here. So we write the Fourier transform of that function here. Okay, so this is the Fourier transform of this function f of tau, that thing here. Ex, if you remember, was En minus E naught. And generally, this Fourier transform is going to be non-zero, even for positive Ex, even when En is larger than E0, even when we are asking for the detector to get excited. The probability for this to happen is generally going to be non-zero. We don't even have to put in a specific path. I invited to put in the path of a detector of constant acceleration. I gave you the formulas at the beginning. But you don't have to even put those in there to see that this Fourier transform has no reason to vanish for positive Ex. For positive frequencies, why would that vanish? It doesn't in general. But that means that the probability amplitude for the detector to get excited and the field to acquire a new photon of momentum k tilde is non-vanishing if the detector is accelerated and the field and the detector both started out in the ground state. And that's the Unruh effect. Yes, I'm getting to what kind of excitation you get. So for example, when you do it for the constantly accelerated observer, either do it yourself or look it up in the standard textbooks like Birrell and Davis, and you find that the probability of excitation, this P infinity, is identical to the case in which the detector is not accelerated at all. But instead, it is sitting put inertially, but exposed to a heat bath, to a heat bath of temperature capital T proportional to alpha, where alpha is the acceleration. You see, if you take a detector and you expose it to an environment with a certain temperature, then you can calculate what the probability is that it is in the first excited state, second excited state, third excited state. And you know how to calculate that. Right, the probability for finding a detector in the energy at the energy level En is equal to a normalization constant times e to the power of minus En over kT, k being the Boltzmann constant, and n is chosen such that well. Let's just put it all in there. Sum over p equal 0 to infinity e minus er over kt. So the normalization factor is such that this probability sum up to 1, right? It's just the Boltzmann factor. Well, and we calculated here also the probability for the detector to be excited into the n's energy level. And now what you can show is that if the acceleration is uniform, it's constant in time, then the probability for the detector to be found in the end energy level is actually given by a formula that looks just like that, except that instead of the temperature, you have the acceleration there. Which is why it is often said that the Unruh detector, accelerated Unruh detector, sees a heat bath of temperature. We have to keep in mind that the detector is not seeing pre-existing particles. All it really is that the detector gets excited. Remember that even when the detector is at rest, if you switch it on only for a finite amount of time, it also can get excited. That certainly isn't particles that were there, were there previously. Well, unfortunately, not quite. You need tremendous accelerations to do this. But I think one is close to doing that. See, if you take in an accelerator, for example, particles and shoot them around in a cyclotron, then they will emit photons. They will be accelerated charges that emit photons. Now, in principle, if you accelerated an ion, for example, a molecule stripped of an electron or so, then it's going to be a charge that's accelerated, so it's going to create Cherenkov radiation, and you would expect that there's a back reaction on the molecule so that it gets excited too. I'm pretty sure that that's what's happening, but I also think that it generally either you don't get the right energy scales in this. Now, you need to have a molecule that, on one hand, it has to hold up in the acceleration, and on the other hand, the energy levels have to be small enough, the energy gaps have to be small enough, so that this back reaction effect will actually show. And I imagine that it's probably difficult to arrange for that. But on one hand, it holds up in the acceleration, so you need big energy gaps so that the ground state is stable under the acceleration. And on the other hand, you need small energy gaps so that the Unruh effect is more likely to happen. Right. So, as I said, in the case of a detector that's uniformly accelerated, there is a way to re-derive that same result by using the fact that a uniformly accelerated detector has a horizon. There is a part of the universe that cannot communicate with it because of its acceleration. But on the other hand, what we see here is that the horizon is really not necessary. There is going to be the Unruh effect, even if the detector is only non-uniformly and only temporarily excited. All you need is for this Fourier transform to be non-zero, and in general, it will be for positive values. Now, on the other hand, it does look. Oh, there's one more comment. Yes. How about the energy conservation in this? After all, what we see is that in the Unruh effect, the detector gets excited and the quantum field gets excited. What about the energy balance? Who's paying for that? Well, you can show that who's paying for that is the agent that does the accelerating. That agent is being back-reacted upon and has to put in energy in order to achieve the acceleration. So for that, you need the third quantum system, the one that does the acceleration. And you see that it's at its expense that this energy, that these excitations come about. As I said, the interpretation of all of this is really not that mysterious. You have the quantum field of the detector interacting with the quantum field of the field. The detector has a charge, it's accelerated, it creates excitation in the field. It's no surprise that the field not only gets excited, you know, a particle of momentum k tilde gets produced, but also it will act back on the detector and excite. Now let's look finally at the special case where the quantum field starts out in a state where there is a particle of momentum k. And the detector, let's say, sits at rest. This should give us confirmation of our interpretation of the mode oscillators as telling us how many particles there are. That if some mode oscillator is one-fold excited, that there's one particle with that momentum of that mode oscillator. So remember that the probability amplitude for the detector to get excited is this expression. And here we now remember the freedom to put any arbitrary initial state you want. Let us put as initial state a state where there's one particle present. Remember that when there was no particle, it was the vacuum, then we said we can forget about this term when you put all of that in here because the A will act in the vacuum state. But now it's no longer true. Now we have one particle state here, and now we can act with A and with A dagger
on that, then there's no reason to expect a zero. But let us think about what we have to use for capital Omega. Well, if we take that term, then we have a one particle state. This is a lowering operator, so that gets us down to a zero particle state. So Omega could be the vacuum. But also, we could raise the one particle state to a two particle state. So there are, in principle, two candidates for non-zero contributions. In practice, we don't expect the second term to contribute, because what would it mean? It would mean that we start out with the quantum field in with one particle, and then the detector registers something, and we have two particles in the quantum field. That's unlikely. Because it can happen if you switch the detector on and off very quickly because of your energy uncertainty principle. But if you give the detector infinite amount of time, energy is sharp, that shouldn't happen. We don't expect this to contribute much. On the other hand, it is quite reasonable to expect, and that is the standard process of quantum field theory, that the quantum field loses its excitation, starts out with a one particle state, then this operator lowers it to the vacuum state, and the vacuum state is the outer state, is the state that we see the field in after the detector got excited. So there should be a finite probability amplitude for the quantum field to lose its excitation, its photon gets absorbed by the detector, and the detector gets excited. So let us look for that. I will leave that for you as an exercise, in case we are out of time. So I leave it to you as an exercise to show that if the observer is inertia, then in the cases A and B, remember those were those two cases where they're looking either for the vacuum here as the outgoing state or the twofold excited state, then we see that no contribution is there if the detector is always on. So the probability that the quantum field gets into its second excited state, there is one more particle, that probability is zero if the detector is inertia. We can see that in this expression here, we get just the same argument as with the delta function. Sorry, I gave it away. It was an exercise to figure out that it really is just the same thing with the delta function. It just never peaks. On the other hand, if you make the epsilon of tau non-zero only for a finite amount of time, the energy time uncertainty principle allows this to happen. On the other hand, if you choose to look for the detector ending up excited and the quantum field having lost its photon, yes, that can happen. That can happen, and you can check that this can happen if the detector is always on, only and exactly only if the energy gap of the detector, so En minus E naught, if this is the state you're looking for, is equal to h bar omega k. So if the field has one particle of wave vector k such that h bar omega is the energy gap of the detector, then you can have the detector feeds that particle, that it absorbs it. Field goes down to the ground state, detector goes up to the state of the end. However, this, of course, is going to be a peaking of that delta function that you get when you do this Fourier transform. And remember that the epsilon of tau is non-zero only for a finite amount of time. And this delta function that comes out of the Fourier transform is no longer really a delta function. And this is no longer strictly required, which means that the energy fluctuations due to the time energy uncertainty principle allow us to detect photons of a certain momentum, even with a detector that's slightly decued. But please try out those things yourself that I only indicated without giving you the actual formula. It's always just little variations on the same theme there. It's not exactly the same equation. But I think it's an important thing to couple the detectors to the theme. Try yourself.
That line is like a finite width within, say, atomic spectra. like the you know emission spectrum or absorption spectrum isn't exactly you know straight line. Is it the same?
That's very much related. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You see an energy state of the if you have an excited state of an atom that is very unstable. So it can very quickly decay. It can stop into the entropy field such a decay very quickly. Then you have a short time interval, larger energy uncertainty, and that resonance curve for absorption is wider. If on the other hand you have a very stable energy level, then it's sharper. For exactly that reason. Okay, see you next week then. Thank you.